The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
So this is the fourth episode of Unsound Methods. We've made it further in our series than the Godfather movies.
Yeah, indeed. I guess it's a good time for us to introduce ourselves a little and explain why we came up with this idea for a podcast focused on literary fiction. So I'm Lachlan Bloom. I'm the author of The Wave, which was my debut novel published by Dead Ink Books. I also write some shorter prose fiction and screenplays.
And I'm Jamie Batchin. I'm currently putting the finishing touches to my novel Siphonophore, and I've also written bits of journalism and short stories dotted around the place.
The idea for Unsound Methods, I guess, came about through conversations with other authors about their process and the motivations for writing, and the realisation that people were coming at the craft from very different angles and very different reasons for writing fiction.
Yeah, I think we found ourselves sort of sat in the pub talking about writing a lot and kind of being very interested in each other's process and craft, and then decided that we wanted to expand that dialogue and get in touch with some of the writers that we were familiar with and see if we could share how they would explain the process and craft with you.
And yeah, it's been very interesting over the last few months speaking to other authors and getting some really useful insight into the craft, how people go about the process of getting a first draft, editing, going through the process of publication, and what drives authors to write fiction that's maybe less mainstream than the more commercial end of the market.
Absolutely. I mean, I think ignoring personal experience, I kind of felt that each writer we speak to would have a different way of going about the process as a whole, and not really paying attention to the fact that there are as many different ways to go through the process as there are books.
So in episode 4, we speak to Michael Stewart. And
Michael is a novelist, playwright and short story writer. He's based in Yorkshire. He's originally from Salford. His books include King Crow and Cafe Assassin, which are both published by Blue Moose. The collections Couples and Mr. Jolly, they're both published by Valley Press. And Ill Will, which he is releasing this month, which is March 2018.
And in this episode, we speak to Michael about his route into writing, and from that, how he went about writing and staging theatre productions in prisons in his early days, and also his approach to editing and how he gets from the first draft to the finished novel. We also go on to talk about getting inspiration from long walks in the Yorkshire Dales and some of the current changes shaping the publishing industry.
On a technical note, we spoke to Michael remotely. That's the first of the interviews we've done. There are a few more to come, which we recorded across the internet ether. So it's quite a learning experience for all three of us, I think.
And now we give you Michael Stewart. Michael Stewart, good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
If we could start by talking about your route into writing and when you first started to take writing fiction seriously as a career.
Well, I don't think anyone... Well, I don't know. I mean, my route wasn't typical, but I think lots of writers will probably say the same thing. I left school at 16. I worked in factories for a number of years with no clue, really, no inclination of what I wanted to do. I was writing things, but not thinking about writing as a career. I was just writing out of frustration, out of boredom, out of anger. And something happened when I was working in a factory. I met somebody and... I just had an idea for a story, basically, and it was a novel, and it kind of consumed me for a couple of years, and in the end, I thought the only way I can do this is to give up my job. I've been working for about 5 years. I thought, I'm going to take some time off and just sit down, and I found a typewriter and a skip outside an office. I took it home. I went to a library. I got a Teach Yourself Touch Typing book from the library. I sat for 2 weeks in front of this book and this typewriter, and I just taught myself to touch type. And then I spent a year writing this book, and I wrote a novel, and it was rubbish. And I sent it out to, I don't know, maybe a dozen publishers and agents, and they all came back with, you know, various responses, really, but all variations on a theme, which were basically, this isn't ready for publication. And then I got depressed for a while and didn't do a lot for about another year. And I got involved with a writers group in the end called Common Word in Manchester. And there were writers from all different backgrounds there. Some were very experienced, some were emerging writers like myself. And yeah, I guess that was the first step really to access people that, you know, had experience of the industry really and knew about the industry, because I knew nothing at all at this stage, only that I wanted to write. And yeah, I guess really from there, I just sort of taught myself the ins and outs of it really over a long, long apprenticeship.
Were there any influences at other authors or anything else within the publishing industry that you were kind of aiming for at that stage?
Well, I didn't know any writers. I didn't know anybody in the industry. There were lots of books that had influenced me, you know, really going back to, I guess, the first writer that turned me on was Edgar Allan Poe. So I'd be about 11, 12 years old, something like that. And I've still got it somewhere, a collected works of Edgar Allan Poe. So it was everything. It was always short stories, always poems, always essays. So I read that from cover to cover when I was convalescing from a fever, going to the fever. And that, I think that was the very first book that I thought, yeah, this is something I'd like to do. And then from there, really, I guess, the next book would be a book I'd probably studied at school, which would be 1984, George Orwell. And that was, it still is one of my favourite novels, actually. But that was a book that I read, you know, just as you do at school, really, as part of my English lessons. But it was just a book that blew me away, you know, the ideas in the book and what it was saying about the world, really. And I it really kind of opened my eyes to the idea of literature being not just something that entertains, but something that has something to say about the world.
And when you were thinking of these books that influenced you, did the writers that wrote them that play a part in your sort of imagining of the process?
Yeah. I mean, I remember distinctly going down to Salford Library and getting a biography of Edgar Allan Poe out of the library after reading this book, you know, and just... And I think it was the first time really I'd kind of conceptualized the idea of a writer as a kind of living, breathing person. You know, I think up to that point, obviously I knew writers existed, but I hadn't really thought about the background, you know, what they did and how they got into it and things like that. And so I read this biography, which is quite a sad to tell, because of course Edgar Allan Poe died very young. He was alcoholic. He was miserable. He sort of died in a gutter, didn't he, somewhere. So it wasn't a particularly cheery tale, but it was just the first time, I think, that I started to think about a writer's background. And the same thing happened with Orwell. I forget which the first biography that I got of Orwell. It will have been whatever was on the shelf at the library at the time. But again, I read that book, and I mean, Orwell's from a very different background to me. You know, he's an Eton boy. He went to Burma as a straight out of Eton, really, didn't he, and was kind of in charge of 400 men. So it was from a very different background to me. But I think those two writers really were where I really started thinking about writing as a profession and writing as something that you do for the rest of your life rather than as a hobby or something that you do once you get in from work, you know, that you could actually be this thing.
Were there published writers at the writing group that you went to?
Well, there were a few published writers at the group I went to. I mean, there's a few poets who've been published in pamphlets and things like that, and there were one or two short story writers who've been published in magazines. I mean, there was no one really who was signed to a big publishing house or anything like that. There was a couple of writers who'd written novels and they'd had those published. So there's a writer called Pete Kalu who's still around now. I think he just had his first book published at that point. This would be about 1990. When would it be? 1992. And I think he just had his first book published, and he's gone on to write, you know, a number of books since then. So yeah, so that was really important, that I wasn't just tapping into the critique, if you like, of experienced writers, but also the avenues by which you could enter this world.
Begin with the path to becoming published and stuff, was that through the sort of short story route initially, or did you continue with the novels?
It's quite circuitous, really, because I wrote this novel and it wasn't very good. So I put that away, and it took me quite a long time to write it, and I didn't write anything of that length for a long time after that. I wrote short stories, I wrote poems for quite a long time, I got a couple of things published in magazines. Nothing really happened for quite a long time. I went to university as a mature student, did an English degree, nothing happened. And then after I finished my degree, so we're really going to 1998 now, I wrote this play, I just wrote a one-act play. And I put it on, I produced it myself, I directed it, I designed the posters, I sold the tickets, I wrote the press releases, I designed the costumes, the stage design, I built the set. So I did everything myself, just put this thing on. And got a little bit of an audience for it, and somebody in the audience knew about theatre and education and had done some work in prisons, and he said, look, this is a play that has two men trapped in a room, and you know, if you take this into prisons, they'll get this, you know, they'll get the metaphor. And I said, well, how do you do that? And he said, well, there's this guy at Armour Prison I know, and there's this other guy, and he put me on to these people, and I spoke to them and I sent them my scripts. And they said, yeah, we'd like to put this work on. So the first kind of breakthrough, really, I guess, was putting this work on in prisons. And we put this play on, and it was terrifying because there's no lighting set. You've just got, you know, you're in a room full of 400 prisoners all staring at you. I mean, you see their faces. And they... They're really interesting as an audience because they're shouting at the actors, don't do this, do that, you know, really joining in, and you know, and it's all good fun. So we got invited back to do something else, and at that point I hadn't written anything. So I think they gave us a month or 2 months to come back, and I just went away and wrote something, and we put that on. And so that was really, that was the first time I really started getting paid for my work and started thinking about, yeah, I had a platform. And that kind of encouraged me to write, you know, a number of things, really. And I wrote scripts for quite a long time before I went back to prose.
What was the sort of driving force behind writing scripts or writing the play in the first place? It sounds quite an endeavor to put the play on. Create the whole, not just the script, but the production as well.
Yeah.
What did you have any particular goal you were aiming for with that, or how did that come about?
Well, really, it was just something that happened to me, you know, some years before. I'd been trapped in a shop, basically. I'd got myself locked in, and there was nobody around to let me out. It was before mobile phones, and there was no way I could get out, basically. And I knocked. I saw a man walking down the street, and the door had broken, basically. You could unlock it from the outside, but not the inside. And I managed to get this guy to... I pushed the key through the letterbox, and he took the key from me, and he opened the door, and he freed me from this. I'd been there about half an hour. And he said, I'll give you some advice. And he came into the shop, and he closed the door, and he put the key in, and he said, look, what you want to do is you want to put some wax. You want to get a candle, and you want to light the candle, and then you blow the candle out, and you hold the key over the smoke, and the wax will deposit itself over the key. And then he closed the door behind us, and he put the key in, and he turned it, and he said, what you do is you put the key in, you turn it, and he took the key out. He said, and you'll find where the lock's warped, you'll see the wax has been displaced, and then you just get a metal file, and you file it off, and it's as good as new. And even before he put the key back in the door, I kind of knew where it was going. I said, right, that's good advice. Can you put the key back in the door and we'll go? And of course, he'd locked us in again. So we were locked in the shop for about an hour and a half, the two of us, and arguing, you know, for the first sort of 15 minutes. He was saying, you idiot, why didn't you get this lock fixed? And I was saying, you idiot, why did you lock us in? And there was a lot of that going on. And then we realized we had to sort of work together to get out of there. And this came back to me after I'd finished my degree, and I was just on a bus, just a bus journey, and I just thought this would make a stage play. You know, just two people locked in a room, and it was very intense. And it was funny. It was a kind of comedy of catastrophes with lots of different things that happened. And there was a little window which wasn't really big enough to get out. And I was much slimmer than he was, and he kind of persuaded me to get through this window. It was upstairs. The shop had two floors. And I got stuck halfway in and halfway out of it. You know, it was like a Laurel and Hardy sketch, really. But also, what I realised is that he was an old man, I was a young man. And I thought there was something interesting going on in terms of age and class. He was quite a posh guy, and we sort of rubbed up the wrong way on various things, really. Because we got talking about all kinds of things while we were there. And I thought, actually, this is a good exploration for trapping two people in a room and, you know, with different politics, with different backgrounds, with different agendas. And, yeah, the story's about them trying to get out of this shop, but also the story's about them trying to get, you know, or the conflict between these differences, really. And it just had to be a stage play. It couldn't really be anything else. It wouldn't have worked as a novel because there was no internal plot development. You know, it was all basically them and their conflict on stage. So although I'd never written for stage before, it was just obvious to me that was the medium it had to be.
I can see why that works so well. Did you find there were any challenges, or did it come quite easily to write in script format as opposed to short story or novel format?
I mean, I really took to scripts, and I've always liked writing scripts from that moment on, really. Although I write prose a lot now, I still write scripts, and I do like dialogue. I just really like good dialogue, you know, and I like Pinter's dialogue and Beckett's dialogue and Churchill's dialogue, and I'm really I really see dialogue writing as an art form. And I think often playwrights do that where maybe novelists don't. You know, I think Roddy Doyle does really good dialogue, and James Elroy does good dialogue. But I think lots of novelists, you wouldn't necessarily say the great dialogue writers, you know. So I turn to script writers when I'm writing dialogue for any medium, really, whether it's a book or a stage play or a film or whatever it is. But the challenges really came from the fact that I was completely inexperienced in all the things I was trying to do, you know, including designing the poster, including, you know, just the technical stuff. I had a mixing desk and I had, you know, a PA, and I'd never even used any of these things. So the whole thing was a massive, massive challenge, really, from start to finish. I'd never do it again, I'll tell you that.
It's one of those things where if you set out on it knowing what you know by the end of it.
Well, I'm a punk, really. I mean, I was too young, really, to be a punk. You know, I was born in 71, so punk sort of came to Salford in 76, 77. I was just a little kid. But I just remember being excited by it as a little kid, and certainly the whole post-punk thing. And I think, you know, the whole do-it-yourself thing must have resonated with me on some level, you know. So I was always... I think when you break into an industry, very often it's through persistence, it's through doing it yourself. I think once you're established, then it's different, isn't it? But I think if you're expecting somebody you've never met before, knows nothing about you, to open a door for you and give you opportunities, well, I think that does happen sometimes, but I think more often than not, it doesn't happen.
And what sort of took you back to prose writing, or during the time you were sort of working on scripts then, were you writing various little things at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, I've always just followed an idea and tried to be true to the idea. So the medium, for me, always comes out of the idea. So if it's two people talking and arguing, then it's a script. If it's a character who doesn't interact with anyone in society and it just lives in his head, then it's a short story or a novel, you know. So...
Do you find that changes as you kind of develop an idea? Like you might start with a character who's predominantly sort of self-obsessed or within their own head, and then having thought about the idea a bit more, another character or another strand of the story comes in, and it suddenly morphs in from prose into screenplay naturally, or vice versa from a screenplay.
Absolutely. The more you get to know your characters and they change as you're writing them, and they become more talkative or less talkative, whichever way it goes. But yeah, I mean, I'm constantly adapting my own work. I'll take something that didn't work as a short story and I'll think, why didn't it work? And then I'll try it as a poem, or I'll try it as a chapter in a book, or I'll try it as a script. Or you know, conversely, a script doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Well, we need some internal, thoughts here, really. So I'm constantly looking at my own work and things. I've got, you know, lots of things that I've started and not finished. And I'm always when I've got free time, I'm always going back to those things and finding different ways of representing them, really. And often it can just be a point of view change. So he becomes she becomes he, or, you know, it can be something as simple as that I've just got the point of view, the voice is wrong in some way.
And sort of related to that, at what stage do you know the length of a piece? Do you have a good idea that something's going to be 1,000 words as opposed to 50,000 words from the beginning of the process, or is it a case of writing and seeing where the end naturally falls?
I guess it depends if it's a commission or not. I mean, I'm writing a radio play for Radio 4 at the moment, which was commissioned, so that's a 45-minute play. That's given to me. I don't have to have any say in that, you know. I've just submitted something for, again, it's a commission, but there was no kind of word length. And I'd written something initially that was about 10,000 words, which is too long for a short story, really. But that's just, you know, in the first draft, that's how long it was. And I've just cut it down now to 3,000 words. So I've cut 7,000 words. I've cut, you know, a good deal of the story off. And really just kind of focused on the last episode of the story, really. And I've lost a lot of the backstory, which was just, you know, I guess inferred from what happened later on. I think if I'm just writing for my own pleasure or just following an idea, I'm not aware of length. I just see where it goes. But then, of course, once you've got something, if you want to sell it, you've got to think about where that sits. If it's a short story, then generally magazines require a certain length. If it's a radio play, you know, radio production companies desire a certain length. So then you start have. So after it's written, really, then you need to think about the where it sits, really, in terms of its commercial, as a commercial entity, I guess.
How does that commissioning process work with radio? How much freedom do you get when you first start talking about the ideas for a radio play?
When you get attached to a producer, so you work closely with the producer, and you have this. There used to be certain windows in the year where you pitched. There used to be three slots in a year, and you were invited to pitch for those slots. Now it's a kind of rolling process, so you can sort of again, it's kind of invited, but you throw ideas at your producer. I mean, I've got, you know, a folder basically on my laptop, which is just, you know, loads and loads of ideas. Radio is very, very ideas hungry. It eats ideas. Very often when you pitch something, somebody else has pitched something similar. So they say, we like this idea, but it's very similar. So, I mean, for example, you know, around the kind of 2014 or just before then, I think a lot of writers were thinking about the 100 years of the First World War. And I, along with lots of other writers, were pitching ideas. Another date was next year, isn't it? 2018 is the bicentenary of the Peterloo massacre. So a couple of years ago, you know, I was reading about that and I thought, you know, actually there's a really good angle on this. Lots of women died in the Peterloo massacre. And, you know, it'd been interesting to tell that story from a female perspective. So I pitched this to Radio 4. But even then, 2 years before, you know, that date, people had got in and said, oh, we've already had enough of Peterloo stories 2 years, you know, prior to the bicentenary. So you're just going to have loads and loads of ideas, really.
How do you compartmentalize the sort of commercial demands of fiction writing with just writing to see where it goes? Do you sort of allocate time to coming up with pitches to send to the producer and then spend another day just pursuing your own ideas, or is it not so clear cut between the commercial pressures and the pressures?
When I'm thinking about writing, I'm not thinking about commercial pressures. I'm not thinking about anything to do with anything other than writing, really. And when I'm coming up with ideas for things, it's just, you know, I may be reading a newspaper and it's just something that jumps out. It could be a line, it could be an image. Often a photograph, an image in a magazine, or something's told me. So, you know, I meet lots of people, I talk to people, they tell me things and it kind of sits in there somewhere and kind of comes back. But, you know, and sometimes your ideas have no commercial value whatsoever, you know, and nobody's interested in them. You say, this is a great idea, and they say, no, it's not, it's a terrible idea. So you may have a lot of belief in it, but if you can't convince anybody else, then it just sits in your head, doesn't it? I mean, I've just, the book that's coming out in March is a very commercial idea, but I didn't think of it in those terms. It was just something that was burning away. And, you know, it's commercial fiction. So, you know, it's just a look of the draw, isn't it? Some of your ideas reach across to a bigger audience than other ideas.
And how does your writing process work in terms of the time you spend on it? Do you have a chunk of time set aside each day?
Well, ideally, yeah. I mean, it doesn't really work out that way. But ideally, you know, in the best circumstances, then yes, you know, I would spend 2 or 3 hours a day writing. But, you know, lots of things happen, don't they? Lots of things kind of demand your time. So, yeah, but ideally I'd try and get 2 or 3 hours writing in a day.
You also work in academia, which also involves writing, I guess, but quite a different form of writing. How do you balance the demands of those two aspects of your work?
The two things just balance each other, really. So, you know, you're just learning all the time. You're learning on the job. You're learning from your students. You know, I'm 46 now. You know, I've been around a little bit longer. They're coming in. They're 19, 20, 21. So, you know, they're bringing a different perspective, really. They've got a different angle on things. And when you're talking about something, you know, and you're trying to present it as something that you can teach or that you can put across, you're having to think about it yourself. So you're as the student as well as them. You know, you're learning as you're analysing it yourself. So the two things really feed off each other. And I think also if you're writing all the time, it can be quite a lonely thing, you know, and lots of writers talk about this. And what's really nice about teaching is it's the absolute opposite. You're in a room full of people and you have a laugh. And I just think those two gears, that quite social gear and that quite sort of, you know, you take yourself away, you sit in your office, you don't answer the phone, you don't see anyone. I think the two things, for me anyway, I'm quite a gregarious character, but I like a lot of my own time as well. But I wouldn't want to spend all my time on my own. So the two things really, you know, complement each other, really.
And do you find that the students are coming to you with a passion for being writers and wanting to just write whatever until the day that they die? Or are there people who come to you who, for them, the be-all and end-all is being published and the writing itself is perhaps less important?
It varies tremendously. I've got lots of students who just want to, you know, do creative writing to give them some insight into the writing process. They've got no ambition to become writers. But then you've got writers who are absolutely, you know, burning with ambition. You know, and we've got several success stories this year. One of my students, Adele Stripe, her book, which is called Black Teeth and The Brilliant Smile, and it's a non-fiction novel about the Bradford playwright Andrea Dunbar. It's a fantastic book. But she's had that book published this year by Wrecking Ball Press. It's been shortlisted for the Gordon Byrne Prize, and I've just heard that it's been bought by Little Brown, so it's going to be republished as a new edition in, I think, November. So, yeah, we've got you know, both ends of the spectrum and everything in between, really.
And is that an inspiring environment for you to be working in?
It's fantastic. Yeah, I'm really pleased for Adele. I think, as I say, it's a great book. I kind of knew as soon as I started reading the first chapter, really, that it had a great deal of potential to be published. It just had a heart, had a warm, and it's funny, and it's just a gripping read, you know, and it's such an interesting story. So, yeah, but often, you know, you can't second guess the publishing game, you know. So it's really, really nice when you see a student, you know, just reach out really with something like that. I think it's just so fulfilling.
And do you ever feel it's a problem to be outside of the London bubble, to use the horrible cliche? I know a lot of the publishers you've worked with, Wrecking Ball, Valley Press and Blue Moose, are all based up in the north of England, and there seems to be a really vibrant group up there.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, Wrecking Ball are based in Hull. They've only reset up fairly recently. Shane closed things off for a good few years. My feeling is there's a really vibrant independent scene not just up north, just across the country, really. You know, it's, I think it's very much like music was in the 80s, when you had 4AD and Rough Trade and Factory Records. And, you know, I think there's a really, and other story, of course, have moved up to Sheffield, haven't they, just a few months ago. So I think there's a really, really interesting thing happening in publishing at the moment, which I would say is similar to where music was in the 80s. And in terms of writing, really, I don't think it makes that much difference where you are geographically. Because when you're in an office, you're in an office, aren't you? If you're sitting at a desk staring at a wall, it's irrelevant where you are, really. I mean, for me, I like to get out. I like to get out with my dog. I like to walk the moors. I'm surrounded, you know, within a few miles, I'm up on the moors. A lot of my writing time is done when I'm walking. I'm walking, I'm thinking, I'm writing. I take a recording device with me. I'm a bit like Alan Partridge, just sort of come up with those ridiculous ideas that when I get back home and listen to them, I'm just stupid. But yeah, I've never lived in London, so I can't really speak about London, but I go down to London quite a lot, and it exhausts me. I just find it really, you know, the tubes, I find, you spend hours on them, and everybody looks miserable, I think London's a great place for certain things, and so much goes on there. But I think as a writer, I like time away from the hyperloy, if you like. And I think a lot of my ideas and my writing comes from isolation.
And a lot of the work you do seems to involve fairly conventional and recognisable settings, but with a real sort of uncanny edge to it.
Well, I think we live in a very kind of absurdist world, you know, and those writers, it's like Samuel Beckett and Ionesco and those kind of writers that came out of the 50s and 60s, you know, are kind of responding to the Second World War, really, and the kind of absurdity of that. But I think we are living in a fairly equivalent place, really. You know, you've got, well, at the moment, two madmen with nuclear weapons, and one madman is telling the other madman that he can't have nuclear weapons. I mean, it's a fairly absurdist position. I mean, for me, I like both worlds. I like absurdist writing. I like the surreal. I like social realism, and it's not often that you put it together, you know. And a lot of my work is taking aspects from both worlds, really, and marrying them, finding a situation where it becomes plausible, where actually things that are absurd are situated in something which doesn't break that membrane, really, of social realism. And I'm kind of interested in that, I guess, that line, really, between the two things.
And do you see something unique in fiction writing as opposed to other forms of expression, such as long-form journalism or academic writing, that can bring something extra to your expression? Is there something that fiction writing can do that these other forms can't?
I think it's just to do with emotion, isn't it? I think fiction, whether it's a script or a novel or a short story or a poem, it's about the emotions. I think you connect with the characters, with their internal life, with their conflicts, with their paradoxes. You know, if you're looking at the difference between, I mean, a good example, we're talking about Adele, but Black Teak's a really good example. It's a non-fiction novel. It isn't a biography. It's about Andrea Dunbar, but she imagines her life. She goes into Andrea's head. We have Andrea's internal monologue. And the difference is very stark. You know, if it was just to be a biography, it would be where she was born, what she did. In other words, it's all the external things that happen in her life. We have the kind of opposite of that in Adele's book. We're inside her head all the time. And it gives us insight. You know, it gives us a connection with a character that fact just can't, you know, it doesn't intend to do it in the first place, does it? But that's why we need both, I think. That's why, you know, the internal, the external, the emotional, the intellectual. I think when you read about a character in a factual sense, you're engaging with that intellectually. When you meet them in a novel or another fictional context, you're engaging with that emotionally. So one's the head and one's the heart, I think.
So related to that, do you have any concept of what makes bad fiction? I guess if fiction is aiming to explore the emotional life, and bad fiction is fiction that doesn't do that. Are there any other aspects of bad fiction that stand out?
Well, bad fiction comes in so many guises. I mean, there are so many different ways you can be bad at writing. I've just read something and it's published, so somebody thinks it's good. It's just extraordinarily bad. You know, you've got a character who's running, is in danger for his life, he's running, and the thoughts he's having are, you know, what that building's made out of, how many tons of sand was required to build. I mean, just extraordinarily inauthentic, you know. I think bad writing comes in different guises because it depends on whether you're talking about bad writing, which is just because somebody hasn't learned the craft. So, you know, we start off writing, you've got loads of ideas, but you don't really know how to realise those ideas. Or is it bad writing because it's coming from the wrong place? Is it bad faith? Are you writing something, you know, which you don't really believe in, which you don't really care about? Is it just an exercise? Is it a monetary thing? So it can be bad in lots and lots of ways, really. So really, yeah, I mean, you'd have to categorise bad writing, really, in lots of different ways for it to, you know. I don't think there's anything, any such thing as bad writing. I think there are lots of different types of bad writing.
Do you feel there's any tension between this sort of more analytical, academic approach to creative writing that is sometimes put forward, and that sort of more direct, from the heart writing? Do you find that can cause difficulties in the sort of writing flow, perhaps overthinking a plot when it needs to be more direct, or trying to be too clever in terms of literary theory that can ultimately take away from the end result?
Well, I don't think you should ever write to be clever. I don't think that's you know, I think anything, any lit theory that you apply should come after you've written the thing itself. You know, otherwise I think it's just going to get in the way. I think, you know, academic writing is the intellectual writing we were talking about. You know, it is analysis, it is critique, it is, all of those things, really. But for me, there's no distinction, because what I do is I have two kind of worlds, and I categorize them differently, and I enter them at different times, and I don't mix and match. I don't write a lot of academic work. I mean, I do write occasionally for journals and things like that. But it's just a totally different gear. It's a totally different way of writing. We ask our students to come in and analyse their writing and apply critical theory to it, but only after they've written it, you know, as a kind of retrospective exercise, really, because you can't do that before. You just have to let the story be the thing it is.
You said the new book's coming out in March?
That's right, yeah, March the 22nd it's out.
What's the new book called?
Well, it's called Ill Will, and it's the untold story of Heathcliff. So it's in Wuthering Heights, Heathcliff runs off in a storm, he's missing for 3 years. And this is a book which, you know, takes him on that journey, really. Turns him from a stable boy into a psychopath. So it was a lot of fun to write. It's nice to turn somebody into a psychopath on the page.
That's an interesting route. I don't think I've seen sort of Wuthering Heights that's informed other fiction. I'm sure there's stuff out there.
So I really wanted to take my character, and I do. I take him from Wuthering Heights. I take him into, first of all, the industry of rural work. And then I take him to Manchester, and we see the Industrial Revolution, and we see, the good and bad of that, really. We see chimney sweeps, and we see children in mills, and we see all that. But then I take him to Liverpool, to the slave trade and the exploration of that. So it was an opportunity, really, to kind of show the social history of the 18th century, but also just tell a revenge story about a character who has this big question: what happened to him? How did he turn from one thing to another? Why is he so wealthy? Why is he so educated? So there are all these questions that Emily Bronte just leaves the reader with. And I read an essay by John Sutherland years and years ago called Is Heathcliff a Murderer? And it's just you know, an essay about how he turns from one thing to another, and it looks at how he is when he comes back, really, and how he pursues Hindley. And John Sutherland's theory is that he's killed Hindley. It's kind of very ambiguous in the book, isn't it, whether Hindley is dead because he's drank himself to death or so. But John Sutherland feels very strongly that he has murdered him. So my question is, well, if he's murdered him and he does it so casually and he does it so lightly, has he done it before? You know, so I started thinking about just exactly what had happened to him, really, during that period.
Sounds really interesting. Isn't it?
Yeah. I look forward to reading that. It's March, you said. It's out next year.
Yeah, the hardback comes out in March. Yeah, we're just the proof copies are out now, but the hardback will be out in March.
Well, yeah, thank you very much for spending some time to talk to us.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's been good fun.
So that was Michael Stewart. You can find Michael online at michael-stewart.org.uk or on Twitter at
headspam. That's the word head, the top of the body, and spam, the popular cuboid meat sandwich filling.
And you can find both of us online as well. I'm Lachlan Bloom, at Lachlan Bloom on Twitter or lachlanbloom.com.
And I'm at Jamie Batchen, spelt in the obscure way you'll find by looking at our website, or my own personal website is jamiebatchen.com. Thank you for listening.